This is part two. That's okay. We'll always make it up. Part two of the. So we'll do a bit of a review. So we're part two on making anxiety work for you. Thank you. Based on this book, Thriving with Anxiety by Dr. Rosemarin. Partly based on, I should say. And I want to just begin with a little review from last week. So we talked about one of the problems of anxiety is the fear of anxiety. And when we fear anxiety and we look at it as a terrible thing, then it gets worse and out of control and it becomes debilitating. But if we understand that it's normal and it's sometimes a trigger for better things, then it's just a question of what we do with it. And we talked about this concept last week of the two sighs, the two kvetches, right? The one that is a sigh of despair, or the other one's a sigh of urgency. Similar to the idea of going through an experience and being overwhelmed and asking lama, why, or lama, what, for what? Is it a test, nisayon, which also in Hebrew means to lift up, as we explained last week. In the book, he gave a nice example that when we start to feel anxious, it's a little bit like a smoke detector that goes off, smoke alarm. And we should pay attention to it rather than be scared of it when we run around and start to turn off the smoke alarm rather than taking the burning pot off the stove, then that becomes a problem and it gets worse. We also discussed the idea that anxiety is actually worse in societies of affluence because we become so used to being comfortable and we're scared to be uncomfortable, and therefore we become more scared of anxiety than we should be. And then we'll discuss the idea of emunah and bitachon. Okay. So today I want to just cover or talk about something based on chapter one of the book in terms of his various strategies. And he points out a very interesting thing, which I want to... Two ideas coming out of the first chapter. The first is an interesting idea to talk about stress and the relationship between stress and anxiety. Because he has an interesting piece in that first chapter where he actually says that stress and anxiety are two different things. And he defines each one, which is quite interesting. They're both connected, and the truth is that both of them, in anxiety and stress, the initial feelings could be a healthy reminder to change, but we need to know what to change, right? So it can be a result and it can ignite a process of healthy growth, but it needs to be... You need to understand what it is before you can know how to fix it, right? In other words, you need to know what's broken before you can fix something. So he begins with a story, as he does in the book. He does a lot of case studies. Talks about a mother called Jen, who had a lot of young children, holding a full-time job, lots of different priorities, lots of different life demands and things like that. And she said, you know, I like spending time with my family, your husband's wonderful, all the stuff, right? And then she says, but with all this, I'm having all this anxiety, she says, right? She came for anxiety. I'm feeling a lot of panic, including difficulty catching my breath and heart palpitations and so on and so forth. And she says, I've got physical sensations, uncomfortable physical sensations. I have this dread that I'm not going to be able to make it through the day. All this kind of, she was describing the anxiety that she has. So he writes and he says, after waiting for her to finish, I smiled and I says, Jen, I have good news for you and bad news for you. She says, please, can I have the good news first? Says, the good news is that you're not anxious. So she says, what are you talking about? Of course I'm anxious, right? He says, no, what you're describing is not anxiety. The bad news is that what you're describing is stress, and they're very different. And let me just tell you in a nutshell, and then he develops it. He says like this. He says, and I'll read you this paragraph. He says, as we'll see later in this chapter, when people have a fear reaction, right, such reaction of fear, that is disproportionate to the actual level of threat, that's anxiety, right? She says, great, but what's stress? She says, when people have an excess of life demands over and above the resources that they have to meet those demands, that creates stress. And they're very different. So, let's break it down a little bit and we'll elaborate on certain points. So he says that each human being, now we'll see if this is completely true or not, but each human being has a limited number of resources, right? So we have in different areas, like time, that's a defined thing. Emotional strength. So in other words, two people can have the same amount of time, but that doesn't mean that both can accomplish the same things in that time, right? People have resources of friendships and connections. That's a bit of an undefined resource, but it is. Some people have better connections than others. Some people have a better support system than others, and so on. So we all have resources. We have finance, whatever it is, right? Family commitment, family. We have family, which is also a resource. But that also brings demand. So he says that when the demands placed on us outstrip those resources, we experience stress. Okay. Now, it's a really important thing to be tuned into our stress levels, right? Because we need to know, like we need to be aware. That's part of mindful living. We need to actually have that consciousness and that awareness about to what extent our life demands are exceeding our resources, right? So he explains this to her in this case study. She says, yes, but I'm having palpitations. Of course, it must be anxiety. So he says, he explains that it's true that a lot of times stress manifests itself in the same symptoms as an anxiety does. That's true, right? See, in this case, why do we need to know the difference? And the answer is obvious, because you need to know what you're diagnosing and what you're dealing with in order to know the strategy. The strategy is different, right? And he sort of worked her through, and he sort of proved it to her that her panicky symptoms, what she thought was panic attacks and anxiety, goes up and down depending on the demand she has on herself. So, right? So like, she says, like, yes, like the other day I was at work when my son's school called and said he was running fever and I could come pick him up. Well, we were short-staffed at work and I was in the middle of helping her family, had just been evicted, find a place to stay. So, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So her heart palpitations and her, what she called anxiety, went up. She says, that's right, because you had more demands that day and it was more disproportionate to the resources that you had, right? And that stress can be a terrible thing. Stress, by the way, is can be overwhelming. High levels of stress are not good. We know that from other research. High levels of stress can actually cause health problems, physical health problems. It can cause heart issues, etc., etc. Stress, being over stressed, certainly is not a good thing, right? So he goes on to explain. He said, listen, there's only two ways to fix stress, right? The first is you've got to either increase your resources, right? Or you can reduce the demands. It's a very simple mathematical equation, apparently. Now, ideally, of course, it's good to do both, but not everyone can do both, right? Okay, so we're going to talk about a little bit what that looks like. But before we do, he says even stress, just like anxiety, needs to be paid attention to, right? And it can be a positive. He says, in many cases, anxiety-like symptoms, which are actually stress, is like the canary in the coal mine. In other words, it reminds us that we need to do something about the way we living. Cardiac, he says, an interesting thing. Cardiac heart disease apparently is the leading number one killer in America. And a lot of that comes from stress. Right? It has an effect on blood pressure. All sorts of things can happen, right? So when a person is experiencing stress, it's something to understand what it is and to do that mental reflection about the balance between our resources and our demands and to pay attention to it and do something about it, because it is, when it's caught early, just like anxiety, it can actually be a positive rather than a negative. It becomes like a reminder to us that things are a bit out of control and we need to do something about it. Now, before we talk about the strategies, I want to just go to something else and just explain an important idea. And that is, stress is not always a bad thing. And also, number one. Number two, besides being a reminder, just being a bit stressed doesn't mean that we're in danger, right? Maybe nowadays when people start to be stressed, they think they're in danger. But it doesn't always mean that. And unfortunately, stress is often confused with hard work, right? Having to work hard is not stress. It's called healthy living, right? Because sometimes we have to work a little bit extra hard for whatever it is, whether it's in our day-to-day life, whether it's in our family commitments, whether it's in our spiritual growth journey, whatever the case is, working a little bit out of our comfort zone pushing ourselves a little bit is not stress. It's just hard work, and it's healthy hard work. Yeah.
But didn't you just say that when your demands exceed your resources, so if you're pushing yourself outside, then you're creating a certain level of stress.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I want to explain. One also has to be very careful. It is really important to assess our resources and assess our demands. The problem that is prevalent nowadays is that people miscalculate their resources a lot of times.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying, we should pay attention to stress. And bad stress is not a good thing to be, right? And sometimes we are doing more than we should be. But there is a tendency today to underestimate the resources that we have.
Right.
I'm talking about internal resources, right?
Yeah.
Because, why am I saying that? Part of that becomes because people generally, and particularly nowadays in our society, don't like to go beyond themselves. And going beyond yourself often becomes like a real stressful situation, right? So just because I'm uncomfortable doing something, that doesn't mean I'm stressed. That just means I'm uncomfortable. It's like we spoke about last week, right? So we shouldn't mix the two things. It is not good to be stressed. It is very good to be uncomfortable. Not all the time, I'm just saying it is. It's a good experience to experience discomfort, especially if it means if I'm pushing myself a little bit harder. Especially in my emotional journey, in terms of making room for others, making room for others' perspectives, making room for doing things for others, right? And sometimes the way to reduce that stress is to understand the importance of pushing ourselves, right? There's a verse that says, "Adam la amal yivaled," a person was born to toil, right? We have this concept in Torah learning all over the Talmud. It's not just enough to learn, one has to, it's called yigi'ah, one has to toil in learning. Got to work hard, right? There's a story in the Talmud where there was a non-Jew who saw one of the great sages of the Talmud. He was trying to work out a passage in Talmudic thinking. And he was, so to speak, stressed. He was really working hard. It was very complicated. He couldn't understand it. He couldn't analyze it properly. He says, listen, it's your fault, you know, when the Torah was given, you guys just committed without finding out what's in the product. You should have done a risk analysis before you committed to the Torah at Mount Sinai, right? But that's what we did. We did commit. It's true. We said, Na'aseh v'nishma. We committed before we understood. We said, we'll just commit, then we'll work it out later. But that's fine, because that's what we do, because we commit to going into something that is beyond our understanding sometimes, beyond the human intellect, and we have to work hard to tap into it. That's an intellectual basis. And an emotional basis, sometimes we know we should be doing something, right? Like I shared this with you once, where I read in some literature about the importance of saying no, which comes up later also. It's an important thing. So it was Gabor Mate, who by now you know I'm not a very big fan, but especially now after October the 7th. He says there's two scenarios. A friend says, you meet someone you haven't seen for a while. It's not a particularly amazing friend, but, you know, it needs a bit of attention or a little bit of care. And he says to you, why don't we go out with a coffee? And you don't really want to go, so you have two options. You say no, which is, he looks at it as a strength because you need to learn to say no. Or you give in, you say yes, just because you feel guilty and you don't know how to say no. So you say yes and you stress yourself out, right? The problem is he doesn't talk about the third option. And the third option is, I say yes out of a strength, not out of a weakness. In other words, I don't want to go. I'm perfectly capable of saying no. But I say yes because I want to do something for somewhere else. And I know that can make that person happy. Now, it might be difficult for me. It might be a little bit inconvenient for me today. I might not particularly enjoy the company. But I did it because I think it's important sometimes to do something for someone else. Right? That's not stress. It's described as stress today sometimes. Oh, it's so stressful. I have to spend half an hour with this person, right? Yeah, I mean, spending time with some people is stressful, but sometimes just to do it because it's the right thing to do, right? Now, we have to put it in balance and so on and so forth. But I just wanted to say we are born, and this is something we talk about a lot, right? We are born, our life journey includes being uncomfortable. It includes having struggle, and that's okay. Struggle is not stress. Struggle is struggle. And it includes urgency, right? It includes a sense of urgency. There's a very famous, in fact, I don't know where it was and I couldn't find it, so I Googled it and it came up all over the place. It's a very famous video of Rabbi Dr. Twersky talking about the lesson that he learned from a lobster. Now, he didn't eat any lobsters, I promise you, but He researched how lobsters grow. And apparently, and in fact, I wanted to refresh my memory, and I found that actually not even in his work. I found an article that some corporate guy, non-Jewish corporate guy, ran a seminar, and he wanted to push people beyond the comfort zone, so he quoted Rabbi Twersky, which is quite interesting. So Rabbi Twersky asked the question, he says, how do lobsters grow? Do you know how they grow? So a lobster is a soft, mushy animal, apparently, that lives inside a rigid... I've never seen one, by the way. I mean, a picture, but not... Right, a lobster is a soft, mushy animal that lives inside of a rigid shell. Now, the shell doesn't grow. Did you know that? The shell is rigid. It doesn't grow. What happens? As the lobsters grow, the shell becomes very confining. So the lobster feels itself under pressure and uncomfortable. So what happens is it goes under a rock formation to protect itself from predatory fish, casts off the shell, and produces a new one. Right? Eventually when that shell becomes very uncomfortable as it grows, back under the rock. And lobster repeats it numerous times. That's how lobster grows. In other words, Rabbi Twersky says, if you want to grow, you need to feel uncomfortable. Right? You need to feel uncomfortable. And when you feel uncomfortable, it's time to shed the shell that you have and then grow a new one. Yeah, so of course we have to have protective gear. Of course we have to protect ourselves in life, but not that protective mechanism that we develop in our life journey cannot be something that restricts us. It's got to be something that protects us. It's two very different things, right? Sometimes in the name of protecting us, we just don't grow. Like we kind of subconsciously or even consciously say, I want to remain stuck the rest of my life because I'm protecting myself, not to become stressed out, or not to become not me, or I'm protecting my authentic self, as they're talking about today, and so all that kind of stuff, right? So sometimes when you feel uncomfortable, it's a trigger to grow. Why do I say this? Because I think something else that needs to be understood, and he doesn't bring it out in the book, and it takes thinking, and of course we have to know what is true and what is not, right? But when we talk about demands versus resources, it also depends what resources we're talking about. For example, we talk about emotional resources. Sometimes we have more resources than we know. We have more potential than we think, right? So it's not good just to suddenly assume this is the resources that I have. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we have more resources than we think we do. We're just afraid of being uncomfortable. We're afraid of that healthy, stressful sort of struggle which we all need to do every day, really, right? Because that's how we grow. And that's why we become a better person. That's why we become a person that's beyond ourselves. We go higher than ourselves. That is hard. Yetziat Mitzrayim, going out of our personal Egypt every day, is a difficult journey. It wasn't easy. It's a difficult thing to become unstuck, because the human tendency is to be stuck. Right? That's the default human tendency coming from the animal soul, because we are by default, at least animalistically, we are egocentric. So we don't like to go beyond ourselves. So when we're discussing stress, it's an important thing to understand that not always when we feel uncomfortable is that stress. We have to really know when we're feeling stress. It's more like when we start to really be overwhelmed, when we start to really feel those symptoms that woman was describing to this doctor. The other thing to bear in mind, I think, is that even when it is really stress, it doesn't mean that current situation of stress will always be that way. Because maybe the way I am now in terms of my growth, right, I'm talking about emotional growth or spiritual growth, whatever the case is, maybe the demands are too stressful. And maybe I need to take a break, but that doesn't mean it's always like that. Because as I become stronger, I don't mean resources in terms of external resources like money and wealth, things like that. I'm talking about internal resources, right? Maybe as I grow, I become aware that I've actually added to my resource bank, which then allows me actually to come back and revisit and take upon other things. As I was just preparing this, I was talking about that life has urgency to it, and sometimes we do need to be a bit overwhelmed and stressed. It's not completely that connected. I'll just share with you because it's a very interesting piece of the Talmud. There's a halachic piece in the Talmud, which the point of me sharing this is not to go into the halachic analysis, but it just brings that interesting point. So it's part of the Talmud we learn even with young kids when they're starting off learning Gemara. It's about when you walk in, it's about the laws of damages. So when you walk in the street, right? And let's say someone is carrying some jars, like I'm carrying glass bottles, let's say, right? And I walk in the street and someone bumps into me, right? And the bottles slip and they break. So the question is, who is responsible? Halachically, it's a legalistic piece of Talmud, talks about laws and damages. Who's responsible? Do we say, I'm responsible to look where I'm going? Or was the person responsible to look where he's going and not bump into someone that has bottles, right? So the answer, if I remember correctly, is it depends. If it's a normal day and we're both walking normally, then actually it's the other person that's responsible, right? No, sorry. Other person's not responsible. Because you walk in the street and you're carrying bottles, you should look where you're going, basically, right? And don't bump into people. However, if that person is running, which is not the normal way of walking the street, it's legitimate to say that I wouldn't have noticed him. And therefore, the fact that he now ran and he's running in the street, which is an abnormal way of walking in the street, and he bumps into my bottles, he's responsible to pay, right? That's the law. Says the Talmud, there's one exception to this law. And that is Friday afternoon. Why? Because if you're walking in the street on Friday afternoon, you need to know there are people running in the street. Okay? Don't tell me the street's not for running. It is. This is pre-people exercise regimen. Maybe it's different today. I don't know. But I'm saying, in ancient times in the street, no one ran. Exception, Erev Shabbos. Erev Shabbos, people run. Why? Because Judaism is structured that there are times of urgency. Right? It's not just a calm, beautiful life every single day. We've got plenty of time. There are times that things are urgent. Right? By the way, this Friday afternoon phenomenon is fascinating to me. I've never understood it. Because no matter if Shabbos comes in at 4:15 or at 4:45, it doesn't seem to make any difference. There's always this rush before Shabbos. Which is interesting. Okay. So I bring that up because I think it's an important point to highlight that we do need to pay attention to stress, but we also need to define what's stress and what's just part of life struggles or urgency or working hard or going beyond their comfort zone. And they're very different. So what are the resources we need to look at? So of course, he goes through them in great detail. I'm just going to mention them sort of briefly. One is sleep, obviously. It's important to get enough sleep, apparently. I'm always accused of not getting enough, but anyway. I think you can make it up. No, you can make it up like once a week on the Shabbos or Sunday or something. No, but one should sleep, it's true. By the way, sleep quality apparently is very important. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a nutritionist, I'm not... But the stuff that I've read apparently, like sleeping next to your phone apparently is not a good idea. That's something I have gotten a lot better lately. I've actually leave my phone downstairs now when I go to sleep. So if you call at 2 in the morning, I don't answer, you'll know why. Exercise, of course, is important. Physical exercise, we know there's so many studies now about exercise. What it does to the person, what it does to the person's physical health, mental health, so on and so forth. The third he mentions is the idea of social interaction, connection. He recommends to all his patients never to go more than 48 hours without having a face-to-face conversation with someone they care about, which is fascinating. Right? So that's the resources that we have, and those are the resources, obviously, that we have to increase all the time, right? In other words, the more we take care of our health, in other words, it's you put in to get out. In other words, you put in the right amount of sleep or rest, and you do the right amount, the right amount of exercises. You connect with other people. That builds up emotional resources, builds up inner strength, and it builds up. It decreases the stress levels. But of course, one has to also look at decreasing the demands, right? Now, here again, you see, decreasing demands doesn't mean make myself more comfortable necessarily, because sometimes decreasing demands also takes hard work. Again, even that is hard work, right? So, for example, when we talk about demands, what do we mean by demands? So, it could be work demands, it could be family demands. Okay, so maybe we're saying yes to too many people, maybe we're helping too many people out, maybe we're taking on more than we can handle in work, whatever the case is, right? But it's not always that. We have also these temptation demands. And he makes a very interesting point in the book. He says, one of the demands we have is checking our phone. Right? But we don't think of that as a demand, but I thought it was very interesting, right? Because current research apparently says that the average American, this is written in America, right? The average American checks their phone 96 times a day, which is about 10 to 12 times each waking hour. That's pretty scary, right? So the whole scientific things about the release of, I don't know what you call these things in the scientific language, but like all these pleasure things that we release in our body and so on and forth, that comes kind of creates this urge to keep checking. Do we have a WhatsApp? Do we have an email? So not checking phones so many times a day creates more time. It decreases our demands, but it's not easy, right? We still need that discipline. I guess it, going back to my point before, that being not stressed doesn't mean being having no demands, right? Because it's a different type of demand. It's a demand of disciplines, demand of self-discipline, self-control, and so on and so forth. Second thing he talks about is the ability, the learning to say no. Now, I mentioned this before, but that's an important one. It is important to learn how to say no. It's important to know how to say no to ourselves, no to other people, when we are overstressed. That's true. It just, the problem is with the pendulum of society, the saying no has become almost a religion now, right? So that's a problem. So again, we have to think about balancing those two things. Life has a purpose. Life has a purpose to connect to others, to help others, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, when the demands, we do have to create boundaries. But not that the whole world is about creating boundaries. In other words, the world is not about me. The world is about going beyond me. But I need to be, so there needs to be a me to go beyond me. And therefore, I need to know how to say no sometimes. And sometimes say yes, as long as the yes coming from a strength. But we also need to know that we have to put those two things together. Life is about growing. Life is about going beyond ourselves. It's not only about being absorbed in ourselves. But sometimes it means we have to be able to say no in order to be healthy. In order to do for others, we also need to be a healthy person. Same thing with parenting, right? Sometimes parents find it difficult to say no to anything, but that's not good because parents have to be rested and strong in order to parent effectively. And also, another point he makes with regard to stress is the idea of accepting our limitations. Now, it is true, as I said before, that we have more resources than we think we have, and we have more potential than we think we have. But also, at the same time, we also need to know what our limitations are. Not everyone is as physically strong as someone else. Not everyone has the same talent set as someone else. So we need to be self-aware. Sometimes we need to know that it's just above me and it's not for me, right? And again, putting that together with being bold and taking risks and growing and doing things we thought we couldn't do, both things are true. For all of this, by the way, all of these balances and these nuances and these complex sort of navigation of this process, that's why we come back to something I mentioned so many times, where Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, tells us that we have to aseh lechara, we have to have spiritual mentors, we have to have people that can advise us, people that can, friends, mentors, and so on, because we are always self-biased. And therefore, we always need someone to be able to tell us, to be objective, able to be honest with us and say, no, you could do this, or maybe this is not for you, right? And that kind of thing. So it's always good to bounce off other people, because that's how you go sort of through the process. Now, I want to just mention something that he doesn't mention in terms of reducing stress. So, up till now, it's pretty simple. So we need to know that we have resources, demands, we have to strengthen our resources, decrease our demands, and that's what put it together. But I think there are other things from a Jewish perspective that help also reduce stress, which he doesn't mention in the book. He actually happens to be a religious Jew, but it's not a Jewish book at all. And that is, stress also, like he mentioned before, right? So if you off to an appointment, we've talked about this before, but if you're off to an appointment, and the appointment's in 5 minutes, and you got stuck, and you only have 10 minutes, right? Sorry, what did I just say?
No,
yeah, obviously, sorry. The appointment's in 5 minutes, but it takes 10 minutes to get there, right? So you stress out, right? So, I mean, that's a simple equation that we miscalculated the resource and the demand. It's never good at maths. The demand is 5 minutes, but I need 10 minutes, right? Exactly. Which over here means the demand is stronger than the thing. It's a lower number, but it's stronger, right? Okay, so obviously I miscalculated, but I'm already in it and I'm stressing out, right? Because I don't want to be late if you're a punctual person, right? So there are spiritual things that we need to understand that also have a lot to do with stress. One is something I've come back to, I mentioned many, many times, is the belief in Hashgacha Pratit. Everything happens for a reason, right? That's an amazing thing. Everything happens for a reason means that I am where I'm meant to be. And if the day turned out that I am late on the odd occasion, then I'm meant to be late. It means I wasn't meant to be there in 5 minutes, I'm meant to be there in 10 minutes. You do the responsible thing, you call up, you apologize, you say, I'm sorry, I'm going to be late, and so on and so forth. But that's what's meant to be, right? Often we stress because we thought we needed to go to overseas or interstate, and then the plane's late. I mean, it's a common occurrence nowadays, right? So Hashgacha Pratit is what's meant to happen is meant to happen. Giving up our understanding that God orchestrates every part of our life is a very fundamental part of reducing stress, right? The other part of that is the difference between living, as we've talked about this many times, living inside out and outside in. What do I live for? Am I living for external stuff or am I living for inner purpose? Why do I say that? Because a lot of stress also has to do with people's perceptions of us. Right? A lot of stress comes from that. that what are they going to think, right? So I stress out. Someone walks in the door. I've got to make sure the house is Pesach cleaned, because even though it's not Pesach, but right? Why? Because what are they going to think? They're going to think I'm a disorganized person, right? All that kind of stuff. That's got to do with our own, like, why? Who cares what they think? I mean, as long as I'm a normal person, obviously we do need to take into account other people's perceptions. It's part of life. We don't live in a vacuum. We live with other people. That's true. But sometimes we just need to know what's right. If I needed a rest and I couldn't clean up that much, that's okay. So it's not 100%, right? So a lot of that has to do with how we live. In other words, if we live a complete value-based living, and also we don't live for outcomes, we don't live to impress other people, we don't live to impress the world, it's more about I live by values, then the question I always have to ask myself is, am I living by those values? And if I am, that's fine. If someone had the wrong idea and therefore they were not impressed, well, that's just too bad, right? Obviously, we need to be successful, we need to be responsible, we need to do things to the best of our ability. That's all true. But if we live by values and we understand that everything is b'hashgacha pratit, that is if we can live by that, if we can think about it, if we can remind ourselves all the time, it is an amazing way to live, and it definitely reduces stress to a very, very amazing way. So that's all about stress. Now let's go to anxiety. So how does it work with anxiety? So anxiety is like this. Anxiety is completely different. And like stress, at least in the beginning, it can be a blessing, as we said before, because what it can do, it can clarify and it can be a catalyst for greater strength, greater development. But again, we have to know what it is. So the definition that he gives for anxiety, as opposed to stress, is this: that anxiety is the experience of fear, right, without an actual material threat being present. Similar to like over-worrying, right? So it's fearing something when there's nothing there to fear. Now that could include, by the way, fearing something that could potentially happen, but it didn't happen. Right? Obviously that's more legitimate fear, but it's because it could happen. And you know that it could happen, but it didn't happen. There's nothing now to fear, right? Because fear is something that God created within our emotional system. And when we have a threat, fear is supposed to be responding to a threat, right? That's what fear is made for. Fear is a positive thing. It's not a bad thing. Because what happened, as we know, that when there's an actual credible threat, what they always used to talk about is the proverbial tiger that's about to attack, right? The brain registers the threat and triggers fear, right? That's what normally happens. And then we have a fight or flight response. Either we fight or we run away. Or sometimes we freeze, which isn't a good option. But, right? So, and that has all sorts of symptoms. We start, our pupils dilate. We are going to a whole different physical structure, which is completely different to normal living. And it's in response to a threat, right? Now, as I said before, fear is a good thing. It is a good thing. Because if we didn't fear, we'd be negligent. We'd be able to live. We'd be irresponsible. Right? Life has threats at different levels. And when we see an actual threat and we're somewhat fearful, we do something about it. We fight or we fly or we run away. So we avoid the threat or we confront the threat, right? Which is what we're supposed to do. We do it in the right way. We do it in a way where we can have a good outcome. But that's the point. Anxiety is fear, but it's not the fear that's the problem. Anxiety is a gift. Sorry, anxiety just means that we are fearful of something that's not there. Okay. However, if it's channeled and it's kept at a normal dose, it actually can be a blessing if it's controlled and it's channeled. Why? Because that's the second point I wanted to highlight today. And there's something he makes in the book, a very good point. He said what happens is that anxiety, if it's caught early and it's used properly, can actually ignite extra strength, superhuman strength that we have, and give us more vigilance and more focused in what we do. Right? He tells a little interesting story. He tells about a person in the beginning of his career, that a person came and told him that every time he gets in a car, every time he drives, he has like a panic attack. Right? He gets anxious. So he says it was one of his first cases of panic disorder. So he went to his supervisor to explain. So he told him, so he said, it's very common that people have who are a bit fearful of driving, they get sort of panicky, they have the symptoms of anxiety when they're driving. But he said, let me ask you a number of questions. He says, when you got your driver's license, right, did they ask you if you wear glasses or corrective lenses? They do, right? Did they ask you if you have any neurological conditions like it's Parkinson's or epilepsy, whatever? Yeah, they do. He said, okay, did they ask you if you have a panic disorder? He said, no, I'm pretty sure they actually didn't. He says, they didn't. You know why? Because no department of any transportation would ask you that question. Why? He says, because panic isn't dangerous for driving. Right? And he says, it's an interesting point. He said, I'll prove it to you. I've been running an anxiety clinic for 10 years, and we have seen more than 7,500 patients. Take a guess how many panic patients I've seen in that time who have crashed their cars. You know what the answer was? Zero. Zero. Interesting thing? I never thought of that, but it's interesting. Why? Because actually he says, if you have a panic attack when you drive, you're just going to drive better. You're not going to drive any worse. It's actually going to improve your driving. Now, that doesn't mean it's a good thing to have a panic attack when you're driving, because that's a silly example, right? What that means is that there are times when you do something better when you actually are anxious. Now, not at a high level. High level anxiety is not a good thing, right? Again, this is the whole point where he talks about catching it early, using it as a smoke detector, a smoke alarm to actually do something better, right? To dig deeper into the adrenaline of your soul and find a better resources, find a stronger way of doing things. Now, apparently this is true with people who do public speaking. I remember my grandfather, Allah Shalom. Interesting thing, he was a renowned speaker, he was an amazing speaker. And no one knew this, but except for his family. But every time he had to speak, he was nervous. He was always nervous. Now, according to the research, apparently, sometimes that makes for better public speaking. Because you're nervous. Because if you're just very, very laid back and everything's fine, you end up not preparing properly and you walk in. Okay, what am I going to say today? Have you ever heard a speaker come in and say, what was the topic? What was the topic I was supposed to speak about? I never liked that because that's not a good sign. Right? I'd like to think that before you speak, you know the topic or you have some idea at least, right? Sometimes being afraid is good. You know, there's a story in the shtetl about a shoychet. So in Jewish law, it's interesting that there's, you know, someone who shechts animals, kosher animals. It's supposed to be someone obviously is knowledgeable and skilled. That's number one. But number two is actually we need to know that the person is a very God-fearing Jew. Why? Because there are many, many laws of what makes a slaughtered animal kosher and not kosher. Very intricate laws, how the knife has to be, exactly how you do it, how you check the animal after. And it's normally between the shoychet and God. So you're trusting the shoychet. That's it, right? So therefore, it's always known that choosing a shoychet means to be someone that knows the laws, has a good hand, is skilled, but also a God-fearing person. So there was a story of a shoychet that came to a Hasidic rabbi and he says, I've been a shoychet for a number of years, I'm giving it up. He says, why are you giving it up? He says, I'm afraid. So the rabbi says to him, I want to ask you a question. Who should we give it to? Someone who's not afraid? That's why you're a shaykh, because you're afraid. Right? Because every time you shaykh an animal, you're a little bit nervous that you might mess up and you might not notice it. So that's good. That's exactly the person we want to shaykh. Now again, as soon as anxiety becomes obsessive, it becomes a problem, right? By the way, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is a form of anxiety. It's a very unhealthy form of anxiety. There's no redeeming factor in OCD. OCD is a terrible, debilitating disease that needs treatment, and it's treatable, actually, with difficulty sometimes, but it is a debilitating form of anxiety, and it's a very bad thing, because over-compulsive anxiety is very bad. But a little bit of anxiety is not bad. It can actually heighten you, right? It kind of brings an awakeness sometimes. You know, when the Jews went in the desert after they, this is not from the book, but when Jews went in the desert after they came out of Egypt and they traveled, so towards the end, after 40 years, there's a passage in the Chumash which talks about how God protected us in the desert, right? And it says there that he protected us and he took us, and it's important for us to remember the kindness that God did for us. And he took us through the desert and he protected us from Nachash, Sarav, Akrab, which means snakes, serpents, and scorpions are all things that can bite a person, and the venom is very dangerous, right? So we know that often the stories of the Chumash have spiritual meaning to them, right? So what is the spiritual journey through a desert? A desert is a place of spiritual emptiness. That's always the symbol of a desert, Right? So as we grow through life, being in a desert is not a good thing. We always need purpose. Being empty is a very dangerous thing. We've talked about this many times. And not only that, but sometimes when you're in an empty space, when you're traveling through a form of emptiness, you get bitten. You get bitten by toxicity, right? You become apathetic, you become no mission, no purpose, and it becomes a very, very empty life, full of lack of meaning, which is very, very problematic, right? And that's the symbolism of the snake, the scorpion. But the commentaries ask the question, why does God have to enumerate snake, serpent, and scorpion? So apparently, they all represent different levels in the spiritual sense. They all present different levels of spiritual threat. One's worse than the other. So a nahash, a snake, apparently the venom of the snake is very warm. Very warm, right? The scorpion, on the other hand, the venom is actually cold. Now, they both kill you, but spiritually speaking, they're both very different. Why? Because, you know, when a person is completely misfocused, when a person is completely derailed from purpose and direction and spiritual growth and all of those things that make for a life of meaning and purpose, but the person is very, very enthusiastic about anything, person is a warm person, a passionate person, so much so that they'll always challenge you, they'll argue with you, if you try to tell them, no, it's not the right way of doing things, they'll give it back to you, right? That's far, far, far better and much more hope than a person who's completely cold, apathetic, right? I much prefer a person that argues with me than a person that just says, it's not his head, just doesn't care, right? Meaning, not that they're listening properly, but they listen, not theirs, and goodbye. I'll do my own thing. Nachash saraf akrav. Warmth, enthusiasm, passion, even if it's negative passion, but passion is life. Life means you're awake. If you're awake, you're focused, you're thinking, you're noticing, right? When you're a scorpion, or when you're being bit by a scorpion, that's much, much worse. That's complete apathy. Just couldn't care less. Happens, doesn't happen, I didn't get it, I just couldn't care about anything. People who can't care about anything are dysfunctional. They're not alive. That's not a live person. So I'm just bringing that in because the same thing is the blessing of anxiety. To have a little bit of anxiety is not bad, it means you're alive. It means you're focused, it means you're thinking more. Now, if you're scared of that feeling of anxiety, this is the whole point of the book. If you're scared of that, it's just going to bring to greater anxiety. If you're scared of that, that means you'll become dysfunctional and paralyzed, spiritually paralyzed or emotionally paralyzed. But if you're a little bit anxious, but you say, wow, okay, let me channel that. So I'm alive. That means let me just focus more. Anxiety means I'm scared of something. It's nothing really to be scared for. So if I'm scared about driving, or I'm scared about public speaking, right? So you just need to reflect. I actually have nothing to be scared of, but that feeling that I have is actually not a bad feeling. It just means I'm going to be more focused. I'm going to prepare better, or I'll put myself into it. I'm going to try to take away the negative aspects of the anxiety and not define myself by the anxiety, but use it out for greater vigilance, for superhuman strength, to reminding myself, you know, I can do this. No, I can confront it. I can do it. I'm alive. I'm well. I'm kicking. I'm feeling. I'm beating. My heart's beating. So let me get into it. So that's what he means by the blessing of anxiety. So that's the analogy of the driver, that the anxious driver actually drives better. Now again, it's not good to become anxious because you need to obviously eliminate the fear part. Because when you have fear, when there's no threat, that's a negative thing. But the feeling of anxiety is actually a reminder that you're alive. So you can draw more in the resources. You can focus more. It actually heightens the awareness and heightens the consciousness. And when you do that, if you use it out properly, you can actually use it out to do more. And that's his first point, first of the 9 chapters. He makes the point of strategizing in terms of using the anxiety for greater growth. But we have to keep it, but we have to channel it that way. It's very important early. Because if you leave it to develop and it becomes an over-anxious process, it becomes debilitating. So on that note, I want to share with you an interesting idea that I heard yesterday. It's based on a fascinating description of the Talmud. The Talmud talks about a great rabbi called Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. And there's a tradition that some of the great sages sometimes had the revelation of Elijah the prophet. Right? You know the story with Eliyahu Navi was a prophet during the first temple. He actually didn't die like an old person dies. He went up to heaven in a chariot of fire. and his soul comes down. We have a tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to every circumcision. He comes on the Seder night, but more often than not, he comes just as a spiritual spark. So he's there, right? But we don't see him. However, sometimes we have a tradition, Kabbalistic, that Eliyahu HaNavi reveals himself in a physical body. To who? To people that can merit to do such things. People of great stature, great spiritual self. So the story goes that Eliyahu HaNavi once met Eliyahu HaNavi. Once met Eliyahu HaNavi. And since Eliyahu HaNavi, we have also a tradition that when Mashiach comes, he will be the one to herald the news. He'll want to inform us that Mashiach is coming. So Rabbi Shua ben Levi meets Eliyahu HaNavi and he says to him, "Nu, when's it happening? When's Mashiach coming?" They've all been asking that question for a long time, right? Still asking that question. Okay. So the way the story of the Talmud continues is very interestingly enough, and it's neat to understand the symbolism of it. And he says, "Why don't you go and ask Mashiach? Ask Mashiach when he's coming." He says, "Okay, where do I see him?" Now obviously this is more metaphysical because we're talking, you know, every generation says there's a soul of Mashiach and so on. He says, if you go to Rome, Rome being the symbol of exile, you will see a bunch of people who are suffering at the door, at the gate of Rome, and they're bandaging themselves. And one of them is Mashiach. Why is Mashiach bandaging himself? Because we have the symbolism, which everyone always thinks is a Christian concept. It's actually not. It needs to be understood. But there is this concept, even in Judaism, comes from the Tanakh, actually, about Mashiach bearing some of the pain for the transgressions of the people. Right? The Christians got it from the Tanakh, by the way. The difference is that in their thinking, you just rely on him. Messiah will suffer. We can do what he wants. It doesn't work like that in Judaism. But there is a concept that Mashiach, before Mashiach comes, he goes through the pain of suffering. So he says, you'll see people who are suffering. They have a lot of bandages. They have a lot of wounds. And you'll see that they are dressing their wounds and they are untying their bandages and tying the bandages and so on. And you'll see one of them who does it differently. You'll see everyone else sort of, when they need to redress their wounds, they take up all the bandages, then they start again. They start bandaging themselves again. Whereas you'll see that the one person, he only takes up one bandage at a time. Takes one bandage, redresses it, and then goes to the next wound. He doesn't undress everything else and address it. You'll know that's Mashiach. Okay, so he goes. That's what the Talmud says. He goes. And he finds Mashiach. He identifies him in the way that he was directed to. And then he says to him, "When are you coming?" So Mashiach answers, "Hayom, today." Okay, he's very excited. He goes back. He's coming today. He's waiting for the day. The day passes. Mashiach doesn't come. So he goes back to him, and he says, "You told me Hayom." He says, "Yes, the word Hayom is a part of a verse. And the verse says, Hayom im bekolot tishma'un. It'll be today if you improve, if you listen to God." That's Hayom. Okay, in other words, it's not up to me, it's up to you. Right? You go, inspire everyone else, inspire yourself, continue growing, continue in good things, and when all the good deeds are cumulatively already, I'm coming. Okay. But what's the symbolism? No, I missed that one point. He asked him, "How come you bandage yourself differently?" So he answered him something which is on the surface is a practical thing, but really it's much deeper maybe. He says, "Because I always have to be ready. Because Mashiach's coming is dependent on us." He says, "When the time comes, I can't be caught off guard. So I've always got to be ready. So I can't undress my wounds and then I'm saying, sorry, no, I need another half an hour because I rest my wounds. I need to be ready." Okay, that's one idea. However, maybe on a deeper level, it goes like this. And this has to do with what we're talking about. When we feel anxious or any challenge that we have, right? What we're talking about is not about not acknowledging the discomfort of it. It is uncomfortable. Feeling anxious, even mildly, is not a nice thing. It's not uncomfortable. But the question is like this. What are we going to do? Are we going to wallow in it? In other words, are we going to become absorbed in it? And when we become absorbed in a challenge, we suddenly identify so many other challenges and we keep focusing on the challenges. Or are we going to acknowledge that we have a wound, but then spring to healing and action right away? And that's the difference between the different people. There were people there that all they would do was focus on their wounds. They focused on addressing their wounds. It was all about the wounds. Mashiach says, and Mashiach is not just Mashiach. Mashiach is a symbol of the Mashiach within every one of us, the spark within every one of us, the meaningless in every one of us. We also have wounds, but our focus is different. Our focus is action. Yes, so sometimes the wound hurts. It needs to be changed. It needs to be addressed. It needs to be reevaluated, reassessed what we're supposed to do about it. But we don't spend a lot of time with it. And I think that's a foundation to everything we're going to talk about. Because, of course, anxiety can be uncomfortable. Anxiety can be very toxic. But the point of the discussion, the point of what we're talking about the next couple of weeks also is, how can we use it for better action? Again, going from the lama to the lama. If we just aren't overwhelmed, we just start thinking about it and acknowledging the pain, and we wallow in the pain and then find other things to be painful about, there's no action. And it becomes debilitating, and more challenges arise, and one challenge brings to another. But if when we notice a challenge, we notice one wound, and we say, okay, right away, I want to redress that wound. I want to see how I can become healthier, or how can I use it out? How can I become a stronger person by that wound? That's when action happens. So the same thing. Anxiety at a low level, one point, and this point he makes in that chapter, is when we start to feel anxious, our immediate thing has to be not that we're scared and overwhelmed about the anxiety and we become scared of the anxiety itself. We feel low-level anxiety. We're in the car, we start to panic, or that's a figurative thing to say we're in on life's mission and we're worried about something, we're anxious about something. What am I going to do about it? How am I going to use it out? How am I going to use it to make me a stronger person? And that's the kind of first strategy about maybe it's there to trigger greater strength within me and a stronger and a more improved product in terms of emotionally and spiritually and our development of growth. I was going to make a big announcement about booking for the thing, but I think everyone here is booked. I hope, yeah. If you haven't, the office is there. But we will have a shiur next Thursday morning. We're not going to cancel it. So I'll see you next Thursday morning and then again next Thursday night. Thank you.